So we're taking our show on the road today. We're in the Hungarian embassy in Moscow. Beautiful building. That's a representation, by the way, of their parliament right along the Danube River, one of the most beautiful cities in the world, you should know, Budapest. What we're dealing with today, though, has to do with Europe. We're here because Europe suddenly finds itself in a bit of a quandary. In fact, a lot of people are starting to wonder whether the whole European experiment needs to come into question. And the one country that's been raising these questions all along, perhaps more than anyone, and for the longest period of time, is Hungary, in the form of its prime minister, Viktor Orban, also in the form of its foreign minister, Mr. Peter Szijjártó, who has been extremely direct in confronting Europe and asking them the right questions. So here now, I bring you my interview with Peter Szijjártó. Mr. Minister, it is so nice for you to do this. Thank you so much for taking
your time.
I really
appreciate it. Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. I understand you went to Mass this morning.
Absolutely. That's how I started the day in Advent.
That tells me something about you.
Well, I hope.
Well, I mean, as a leader, I think it's particularly important because if you study anything about, like, St. Thomas Aquinas, it's important, I think, for men who lead to understand that our rights don't derive from you. They derive from something bigger than you and me and all of us, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, I was raised in a very disciplined Catholic family.
Yeah.
Plus, I was enrolled in a very disciplined Catholic school run by the Benedictines.
Oh, no.
Yeah, right. So it tells a lot. So, for example, for me, whatever is early in the morning or whatever is not is a relative question. You know, I remember back the Mass at 5:45 in the high school. So no one can complain to me how early the day starts, I think.
And it's important, right, to start the day that way.
Yeah.
You know, as a man of God, I imagine you understand that we're taught that we are not supposed to hate. And yet you find yourself in an environment here in Moscow, of all places, where it seems like there's an expectation of you as a European that you're supposed to hate the Russians. Don't you find that a little troublesome?
Oh, I do find it very troublesome. But, you know, my strategy is not to take care of these expectations. We are a small country, a small nation, landlocked in central part of Europe. And we are under an intellectual pressure to think as a small country, you know, to always try to adjust ourselves to someone who is bigger, stronger, wealthier, having a bigger army or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we Hungarians have a different kind of mindset. We are not ready to look at the world through the angles of others. We are not ready to look at ourselves through the angles of others. We do stick to our sovereign right to see the world through our own lenses, let's put it this way. And I hate is when my foreign policy strategy is being categorized pro-Russian, pro-American, no, it's a pro-Hungarian foreign policy, which puts Hungarian national interest in the forefront. Hungarian national interest is the compass itself, and I don't care what others think about it.
Dare I say it's pro-common sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Common sense is my favorite expression in foreign policy. Common sense. You're totally right.
And as a foreign minister, you have almost been, you and Prime Minister Orban have been probably the top nonconformists in all of Europe over the past 10 years or so.
Well, definitely we can say that being a patriot nowadays in Europe is kind of a, may I say, unique or not the average. Thanks God, though. Thanks God. There are more and more patriots in the European political scene. More and more patriotic parties getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
More and more patriotic parties winning elections. More and more patriotic parties getting into government. So I think that this kind of patriotic revolution is going on in Europe, at least.
We have millions of people who are watching us all over the world, and some of them may be wondering when you use that word
we have a patriotic form of government. What do you mean by that word? What do you mean by patriotic? Explain.
I mean that national interest is first. Hungary first, may I say.
Yeah.
Hungary first. Make Hungary great again.
At the expense of others?
Why? This dimension doesn't exist in my way of thinking, because my understanding is that this is not a zero-sum game.
Hmm.
So I try to make Hungary better and greater and wealthier again through cooperation. And I do believe that cooperation can bring mutual benefit. And this is something which is missing now from international politics. As you just rightly started, that here you are in Moscow, you are supposed to hate.
Right.
But actually, mutual respect. Mutual respect is something which is missing from international politics nowadays. Why? Because this liberal mainstream, which is overruling the, not so much the global politics anymore, because with President Trump coming into office, this is getting better and better. But before President Trump, the whole global political scene was overruled by the liberal mainstream, and still in Europe, this has been the case. And the liberal mainstream is absolutely intolerant. They do not tolerate anything but extreme liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Once you are out of the mainstream, once you are not falling 100% in line, once you have a national way of thinking, then you are being cornered, accused, lectured, judged, you know, pushed away. And this is something we have to stand up against.
Let's talk about Europe, because I think we're getting almost to that point. I think you're almost leading us there. And when I say Europe, I mean old Europe. I mean maybe the proper terminology these days is the Europe elite, the people who run the EU, some of the people who run NATO, for example.
Brussels,
exactly. Brussels. And you said the other day, and I thought this was fascinating, you said the EU is getting in the way of peace. Those were your words.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
That's my experience, to be honest. So this war has been going on for the fourth consecutive year.
Yeah.
From the very beginning of it, Hungary has been representing a position in favor of peace talks, ceasefire, and peace agreement. For this position of ours, we have been under tremendous political attack in Europe. You know, usually there are 25 other foreign ministers, because the 26th is a Slovak guy who is representing similar kind of position I do. So 25 foreign ministers usually bash me once every month on the Foreign Affairs Council meeting for our position. Why? Because actually they are more interested in prolonging this war than stopping it. And you might raise a question how it can be the case, why you say such things.
Mm.
And because of my experience. So whenever someone tried to make peace, whenever someone tried to stand up for peace talks, these European politicians immediately put a huge hatred on that given person or on that given government, saying that this is the capitulation of Ukraine, this is traiting European unity, whatever. So my experience is that President Trump has been doing his best in order to make peace, while the Europeans are constantly undermining these efforts. And you know, the reason might be that it has now become obvious that the European response to this war is a huge failure from all aspects, a huge failure. And it has now a tangible impact on the everyday life of the European people. And once this war is over, then the European people will raise this question to the European elite, how on earth you have made such decisions which led to where we are. And as long as the war goes on, these questions are not being raised. But once the war is over, these questions will be raised, and I do believe that the European political elite in Brussels is kind of buying time to push it to the latest possible convenience to be confronted with these answers.
I think you just said something which is so marvelous in many ways, because what you're hitting upon takes us back to what we started the conversation with when you say we rule through a patriotic principle. Too many politicians in this world, it seems to me, if you'll allow me to say this, don't make decisions based on what's good for their people. They make decisions based on what's good for other interests.
Yep.
And that's a problem, because you just said it right there. What good does it do the average guy who lives in Liverpool or in Budapest or in Prague or in Paris or in Berlin? What good, what benefit is he getting from the war in Ukraine?
Let me share with you a very sad experience, personal experience of mine, in order to underline what you said about whose interest you fulfill with your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Before each and every Foreign Affairs Council meeting, which takes place once a month, before each and every occasion we discuss anything serious, group of foreign ministers, one by one, come to me, asking me, Peter, you're gonna veto, right? Peter, you're gonna stop this crazy idea.
They're lobbying you.
You're gonna be tough. And I say, yes, I'm gonna be tough. I'm gonna veto. I'm gonna go against. But would that be possible that you do the same? Say, you know, Peter, it's impossible for me because of media expectations, because of NGOs, because of the coalition partners, because of the unstable situation at home. So I have to tell you that on many occasions, I really feel sorry for these guys, because it must be extremely terrible feeling that you have a feeling, you have an opinion, you know what's right, and then you have to represent something totally different. That's crazy. I would not be able to do that. And I'm really sorry for these guys who have to act like this. So this comes back to your question, what kind of interests are being served by the decisions of many?
And that goes back to St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yep.
Laws are intrinsic. The rights of man are intrinsic. You don't own them. With all due respect, you may be one of the most important men in your country. You are, obviously. But you don't own those rights.
Of course.
They're borrowed, and you get to share them with your people. I don't think a lot of people in the United States, in the Republican or Democratic Party, I don't think a lot of people in Brussels understand that. And that's important.
Yeah, that's you're right. It's important.
Let me ask you about Hungary's position, because there's almost a comparison in these days. I've been doing a lot of coverage on India lately, because Putin went to India and had conversations with a lot of your Indian colleagues, as a matter of fact, and they're in a similar situation. They truly believe in their right to do the best for their people, and they have decided that the best for their people is to do trade deals with Russia, in particular because Russia has a lot of hydrocarbons. And Hungary's in the same situation. Hungary's out there saying to the world, look, we want to have a deal with Russia because it's good for the Hungarian people. And you're getting a lot of heat from the EU and others saying, no. Once again, we go back to this conversation about you're doing what's good for your people and they're telling you to do something else. Yeah.
But you know why they criticize us so badly? There are two reasons.
Why?
First, that because they are hypocritical and they do the same, but they just want to hide it. So imagine the LNG exports of Russia to the European Union has hit all-time record during the first half of this year. Now, Hungary buys 0 cubic meter of Russian LNG, zero. This means that those are the Western Europeans who are buying it. Another coincidence, you mentioned India. Look at the structure of India's oil import, how Russia has increased its share. And look at the import structure of European Union member states when it comes to oil. What third countries appear on the structure of the market who have never been there before? So, I mean, Europeans, first, they are hypocritical, and second, they are hiding what they are doing. And, you know, when it comes to Hungary, look, it's crystal clear for us. We have never been ready to look at the issue of energy supply as a political or an ideological issue. Because with politics, with ideology, you cannot heat, you cannot cool, you cannot operate your factories, you cannot create hot water, right?
Mm-hmm.
You need energy sources, hydrocarbons, you need gas, you need oil to operate your country. And for us, this is a physical question. There are the pipelines, and from where you don't have a pipeline, you cannot buy neither gas nor oil.
Yeah.
So it's so simple. Based on geographical and physical determination, yes, we are not able to supply the country without Russian sources. Why? Because of politics? No. Because of physics. Because of the reality. Mm. And if you are not taking reality into consideration, you commit serious, serious mistakes. That's why now we're going to file a lawsuit at the European Court to annul the so-called REPowerEU package, which is the decision of the European Union to ban the Russian oil and gas imports. Look, I mean, I've been in this position for 11 years now. So I've been dealing with relationship to Russia for 11 years, among others. And I have to tell you that the Russians have always respected the contracts we have signed. The Russians have been always reliable when it comes to energy supplies. We have never been cheated by them. They always, when we needed more, they delivered more. When we wanted to renegotiate the price was renegotiated. Hmm. So, you know, I can't say a bad word. My question to the Europeans is, so how I come to the Hungarian electorate and how I tell them, look, ladies and gentlemen, from now on, we are shifting from a cheap and reliable energy source to a more expensive and less reliable. What's the argument?
Yeah.
What's the argument for that?
Yeah. And so, it's not based on market principles.
Come on.
It's not even based on common sense.
Come on.
So why does Germany do that? Why would Germany be in a position where they'd prefer to pay more for their gas, maybe even from the United States, which is a really long way, than rather than get it on a short pipe from Russia?
Well, to be honest, maybe it's well above my merits, but I like looking at myself as a brave person, but I'm not that brave to speak on behalf of the Germans.
Okay. Well said. And I think that's probably smart as well. Although it is a bit of a quandary, isn't it? One wonders, do you care about your people or not care about your people? Because it seems to me if you cared about your people, you'd be trying to get them as much hydrocarbons as you can get on the open market as cheaply as possible. I don't understand, Mr.
What
Merz.
We did not really understand was their approach towards nuclear. I mean, nuclear energy, for us at least, is the best way of generating big volume of electricity in a cheap, sustainable, safe, environmentally protective way.
Yeah.
So for us, nuclear is key. We have a good cooperation with Russia on nuclear. We see that the Russians have a good cooperation with the Germans and the French on nuclear as well, which is with the Americans as well, which is a normal way of division of labor. So we move on with our nuclear investment as well.
Let me give you an optics scenario. Just 2.5-3 days ago, the New York Times came up with a big headline that basically said that the Zelensky government is allowing corruption, in fact, quote, allowing it to fester. Now, move forward 24-48 hours, and that same man that the New York Times says or is implying is corrupt is on 10 Downing Street meeting with Mr. Merz and Mr. Starmer, and they're treating him like he's Elvis Presley. What do you make of that picture? Is that a problem? Is it problematic? I don't want to put you in a situation to talk badly about your colleagues.
But. No, what I want to tell you about this corruption scandal is rather my perspective, because I am a European taxpayer, okay? Yeah. A Hungarian European, or European Hungarian taxpayer. And hundreds of billions of euros of the European taxpayers have been sent to Ukraine. And when it became obvious that there is a state-run corruption system operating in Ukraine, when it became obvious that, you know, billions of euros have been spent to something for which those billions of euros have been not sent.
Hundreds of billions.
Yeah, even hundreds. then the first reaction of the European Commission was not that we stop spending and asking for a clear report about how they spend the money from the Ukrainians. No. Von der Leyen sent a letter to all the heads of state and government in the European Union to ask for more money.
More money.
Plus, we had Foreign Affairs Council a couple of days later, and the first guy, a war fanatic who has mentioned the corruption scandal, he mentioned in a way that the corruption scandal in Ukraine is another reason why to let them join the European Union as soon as possible. And I said, I beg your pardon. I mean, I'm still sleeping or dreaming or having a nightmare. Or did you really say that a corruption scandal is the reason to be part of European Union as soon as possible? I mean, come on, that's crazy. That's crazy. So, I mean, our position is the following. No more money. There has to be a report how the European money was spent. We think that this war doesn't have a solution at the battlefield. This war will not be reverted on the battlefield because, I mean, for the last 4 years, so many weapons have been sent. So much money has been sent. And if that big amount of weapons were not able to revert the tide, then it will be not reverted, which means to us that if there's no solution on the battleground, there must be a solution provided by diplomacy at the negotiating table. So ceasefire or peace agreement, peace talks, negotiations, those should take the lead instead of the battlefield operations.
Yeah, and it does seem like the Americans and the Russians, imperfect as they are, I know my country's imperfect, all countries are imperfect.
Everybody's imperfect.
Yeah, exactly. But at least it seems they're trying to come up with something. I'm not sure I can say that about the Europeans.
No, that's our understanding of the situation. That President Trump has been doing his best since election.
Yeah.
Since election, and if I might be brave enough to say this, if the Biden administration had not made decisions after they lost the election to deepen the conflict, if the European leaders had not made their best to undermine the efforts of President Trump, if the European leaders had not escorted Zelensky to the White House on that famous meeting, there could be peace in Ukraine now.
Hmm.
But unfortunately, the European leaders, the liberal elite, has been undermining the peace process and the peace efforts of President Trump on a daily basis.
And in the process, it seems to me, they're hurting the people of Ukraine. They're not helping them.
I mean, absolutely. We have a Hungarian community living in Ukraine. So through them, we have, we know the situation in Ukraine. And this is devastating.
Mm.
It is devastating. So, I mean, the behavior of the Europeans is so irresponsible because it comes with a big, big death toll, you know? A lot of people dying, you know? I consider Boris Johnson my friend because we served together as foreign minister.
Boris Johnson?
Yeah. He
really?
Was, he was guest in my house with my family.
If you don't mind my saying, you have much better hair.
well, you know, that's well above my merits. Let's put it this way. So what I mean, with Boris, we were, I really liked him. But, the undermining of the peace efforts by the current European leaders is not a greenfield investment because this is what Boris Johnson has done actually back in 2022 when he went to Kiev telling Zelensky that he has to continue to fight.
Yeah.
Although they were very, very close to a peace agreement with the Russians. You remember the talks in Istanbul.
They would have had a great deal compared to what they're going to end up with now.
Look, my understanding is that with each and every day passing in this war, the situation is worsening from the perspective of Ukraine.
Hmm.
Because they are losing ground, losing people. Their country is under destruction. So if they had made an agreement back in April 2022, that would have been a much better deal from their perspective compared to if they make a deal now, simply because of the huge number of people lost since then and the huge number of people leaving the country since then.
I guess I should ask you this question since it's in the news as well. The EU is trying desperately to try and hoard the frozen assets of Russia through some kind of plan where they'll take all or part of those assets and then turn them over to Ukraine. What do you make of that? What do you think of that?
Well, we do not support any kind of confiscation. We made it...
Confiscation, you say?
I mean, if you take something which is not yours,
yeah,
how would you characterize it? So I think that such a decision, confiscating the frozen assets, would have a very, very bad impact on Europe, generally speaking. Let's say that the trust towards European economy, the trust towards the European investment environment would just disappear immediately. So we're definitely not going to support it.
Let me ask you this question about Viktor Orban. The prime minister seems to have this very genuine, almost jocular relationship with Mr. Trump. How did that happen?
Look, I think the key word here is loyalty.
Huh.
Loyalty, which is similarly to mutual respect, is missing a bit from international politics. You know, these two politicians, these two leaders, President Trump and Prime Minister Orban, are among those ones who have been attacked the most in international politics, right? The most. And it could have been easier for both of them, you know, not to support the other under the biggest storm.
Yeah.
Okay. But they did support each other.
Mm.
They never forget about each other. They always remained loyal to each other. And this loyalty creates such a strong foundation for their friendship that is very visible and spectacular, I think.
Yeah, it seems interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you think of Ms. von der Leyen. I'm wondering what you think of Kaya Kallas. They've been in the news.
Oh my God! I'm just coming from a church, you know. So it's very. You are giving me a hard time.
Well, they've been in the news a lot lately, and they're not afraid to come out and make things. But not all the things they say so declaratively seem logical or smart. Kaya Kallas recently said that she had no idea that Russia had anything to do, or China, with the ending World War II, for example. What a thing for a minister to say.
Look, when it comes to Madame von der Leyen, I think that she caused so much harm to Europe that very few others. Under her leadership, Europe became a much less safe place than it used to be, much less competitive place as it used to be. And, you know, the corruption which is there in Brussels is an explanation why Brussels has not raised the issue of the corruption in Kiev. Just remember, the commissioner for justice of her former commission, Mr. Reinders, who was the leader of the anti-Hungary procedure, now is under the charge of money laundering. The commissioner for justice. Now, the former high representative of the European Union, Madame Mogherini, has been arrested for corruption charges as well. The Secretary General of the European External Action Service has been arrested for corruption charges as well. So the way Madame von der Leyen has destructed the European competitiveness, the European peace, the important role of Europe in global politics and global economy, is really exceptional. So, I mean, the harm she caused to Europe is tremendous. And when it comes to Madame Kallas, you know, I think if you cannot disassociate yourself from your personal hatred, personal feelings against certain nations, that you cannot be neither a good foreign minister nor a good high representative. That's how I see it.
It goes back to, we're not supposed to hate.
We're
told by our God, by our parents, by your mother, your father, you're not supposed to hate.
You shouldn't.
If you make a policy based on hate, it's never going to be a good policy.
You don't go anywhere. You don't go anywhere.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering about this peace proposal that we're looking at now, especially when it comes to Ukraine. Do you think in the end that we will have a possibility of peace in Ukraine?
Well, what I can tell you is that we have a huge chance for that now. And I think that there will be no better option for the Ukrainians than this one. All other options, which might come later, will be definitely and surely worse than the current one. So I think that it would be great if everyone accepts this peace deal and then this whole war is being ended. I think it would have such a refreshing impact on the world.
Mr. Orban has suggested, and I think a lot of people think it would be the best place to do it, that Hungary should be the place where this deal is worked out. I'm wondering, if you, Mr. Minister, could talk to Mr. Zelensky, what would you say to him? What advice would you give him that he's not getting from the EU?
Well, what I can tell you is that the basis of my foreign policy strategy is that I can't be smarter regarding the issues of others than the others themselves. So that's why I never interfere into domestic issues of others, because I expect them not to interfere into domestic issues of ours. Now, I don't get this, obviously, but I can't be smarter than the Ukrainians themselves what to do now. What I know from the outside is that peace is always better than a war. So I can just hope that this war can be stopped by a peace agreement. What I see is that the time is not on the side of the Ukrainians. When my prime minister took over the presidency of the European Council, the Council of the European Union last summer, on the very first day of our presidency, he went to Kiev to talk to President Zelensky. And he told President Zelensky that according to our understanding, the time is not on your side. But then he denied. He said, yes, the time is on his side.
A matter of perspective.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question as an American. Maybe
Please.
I should say
Please.
to a certain extent, a dumb American, because we don't understand Europe. We really don't. We know our system. In the federalist system of the United States, we have 50 states. We have another four or five different territories. And they all have their own specified rights, separate from the federal rights.
For Washington, yeah.
Exactly. So we've created this system that kind of works. Sometimes it's problematic, but for the most part, it works.
But it's yours.
But it's our system, correct. That's what we have in the United States, imperfect as it may be. Europe, it seems, has tried to create something like that, where they've taken all these different countries and tried to put it under an umbrella. And that umbrella is called the EU. Seems like a good idea, but I'm not sure it's working.
Look, there has been a big debate, independently from the war in Ukraine, how the European Union should look like in the future. Huh. Now, the war has put this whole debate in a different perspective, but before the war, this debate had been there with us as well. Because there are two approaches in this regard. One approach is a federalist one. The federalists want to centralize the European Union. They want, just to understand, they want to create something like United States of Europe. You know, many competencies to Brussels. Member states should forget about their past. People should forget about their nationality. People should forget about their heritage, religion, culture, history, whatever. Mm. Everybody should be European, okay? Now, this is...
What do you think of that?
Our position is different, definitely. Our position is a sovereignist position. So you have the federalist, you have the sovereignist. And we, the sovereignists, say that, yes, European Union is a great idea, can be a great organization in case it is being built on strong member states. Strong member states meaning strong competences, sticking to heritage, culture, religion, history, being proud of who we are, not being forced to be melted, okay? So we think that the EU can only be strong in case the member states are themselves strong. Now the federalists say that this is stupid. So, I mean, this idea. So that has been a constant fight within the European Union. That was one of the reasons why we regretted a lot the decision of the British, although we respected them, because mm-hmm. that's their decision, their country, their future, their sovereign right. But we regretted their decision of Brexit, because the British were the leaders of the sovereignist camp inside the European Union.
Mm.
And now with the British leaving, this whole debate lost its balance, and the sovereignists are rather in a minority now, but you never know.
What's the future of the EU?
Well, I hope that there will be a patriotic revolution successful. Yeah. And once the patriots are becoming successful, the European Union can become successful as well. But the European Union cannot be successful in the future based on this extreme liberal approach, for sure.
As Ukraine goes, so goes the European Union?
What do you mean?
Well, the European Union has put all of its eggs in one basket.
Yeah,
the basket of Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's not a healthy basket.
Which is not a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. You are a delight to talk to. Thank you so much.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
It really has been a wonderful opportunity to talk so openly about ideas, and you obviously are very good at what you do. And Hungary is in a very unique place right now. Congratulations
Thank you.
For helping to get it there, Mr.
Appreciate
Minister.
It.
Thank you once again.
Thank you.